did that song from the early 80s go? EDA, lift us up where we belong. Where the eagles cry on a mountain high. EDA, lift us up where we belong. Oh, wait. That was Love. Right. My bad. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this here long-running, over 100,000 downloads and still popping, Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by EEJournal.com and hosted by yours truly, Amelia Dalton. Yes, we are flying high this week. So, my friends, to start things off, when I was a little kid, my stepdad and my godfather both flew stunt kites. Many of my summers as a kid involved going to the Oregon coast or the Columbia Gorge and watching my parents fly stunt kites. So, this week's news you may have missed may have struck a bit of a line, or would it be a string with me? Let me introduce you to Kite Power Solutions from Glasgow, Scotland. And their goal is to bring kite energy to the market by 2025. And folks, recently they got a whole lot closer to that goal with a little help from a team from the Imperial Department of Aeronautics and the UK's National Wind Tunnel Facility. So this facility, as it's called, actually consists of 17 different wind tunnels located across 7 UK universities that serve not only the universities themselves throughout the country, but also industrial designers as well. All right, so let me step back a second. Kite energy works like this. Kite energy means tethering a kite, and not just any kite. The Barbie one I had when I was 7, totally not gonna cut it. No, these kites, which can be made from fabric or a rigid aerofoil material, have been designed specifically to be agile and robust as they are tethered to a spool via cables. Now, as said kite moves around in the wind in a figure eight pattern, the pull of the cable turns the spool and the motion of the drum that is harnessed to create energy. So, back to the wind tunnels. In these recent tests, the Imperial Department of Aeronautics actually used two different kites. One about 60 feet long in a high-speed working section of one of the tunnels, and another that was about 20 by 10 feet in the large, low-speed section of the facility. And what Kite Power Solutions learned from these tests and the input from the Imperial Aeronautics team was extremely valuable. Kite Power Solutions CEO David Ainsworth said, "The work conducted in the wind tunnel by the Imperial College London as part of the Innovate UK grant was invaluable to our increased understanding of the behavior of our components. The learning substantially steered our technology direction and ensures that we are on course for commercialization by 2025. Cool! Sign me up, Kite Power Solutions. Also, if you ever need me to visit your facility, maybe do an in-depth report for a future podcast, Chalk Talk, whatever, let me know, and I'll work that into a future expense report. We'll see how that goes. All right, let's go even higher, my friends, all the way to the cloud. Please welcome Joe Sawicki from Mentor Graphics. Joe and I are chatting up a storm about EDA in the cloud, AI in EDA, and why speed and scalability are super important for cloud EDA deployments. Check it out.
Thank you so much for joining me, Joe.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so we're talking about the cloud a little bit. Now, there's been a lot of talk these days about running EDA software in public cloud environments. Now, can you help me wrap my head around what's driving this proliferation of chip design software into the cloud?
Sure. I think when you look at the overall trend here, cloud ends up meaning a lot of different things to different people. In the EDA industry, by far the most important need that it meets is the need for massive amounts of compute infrastructure as you're trying to push a design out the door. If you look at functional verification, you are usually in a mad scramble to push through your entire test bench. You're trying to run that on thousands of different CPUs, and certainly there's a dozen companies out there that have that kind of infrastructure, but there's a lot of companies that don't. And so that ability to push, instantly basically provision a data center that might have taken you a year to build, air condition, power, and instead turn it on as a virtual instance in the space of a second is driving that burst compute mode. It's the same thing with physical verification as well, where you want to do a large chip, you want to run a physical verification run, you want it to be overnight. Well, that's a 250 to 700, maybe 1,000 CPU problem. Being able to provision that immediately, have that as a flexible resource, and be able to get your chip out faster, that's what's driving almost all the interest right now.
Now, Mentor recently announced new industry benchmarks with regard to scalability and runtime speed for EDA software in the cloud. Now, talk to me about why speed and scalability are especially important for these cloud EDA deployments.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you look at what we've been talking about, these have mostly been around the physical verification space. So there's a couple things that had to happen there. We did one announcement recently with TSMC where when you want to run a physical verification somewhere on the cloud, you need to have what TSMC considers to be highly proprietary, highly sensitive data that needs to intercept the customer's design in this public cloud infrastructure. So they've put together whole programs that qualify out the IT infrastructure within the cloud, the security that's enabled there, and then how they can feel safe that their data doesn't leak out. Now, the other thing is, if you think about what we just talked about before, what's the need that's driving here? Well, it's usually because somebody's manager is screaming at them. You know, we're shipping phones come September. The tape needs to hit there in December because it takes 2 months to get the fab to start running. And so I need the design. I need the design. I need the design. Well, to be able to go out there and then run on the, you put 200 CPUs in place and it's going to take you a day and a half to run this, and you take it to 400 and it still takes you a day and a half, that's not what people have in mind. And so, you know, we've done benchmarks that have this thing scaling out to 4,000 CPUs. I don't see a user of mine using 4,000 CPUs anytime in the next 2 to 4 years. But they want to know that they can go 250, 500, 1,000, and being able to show them that, hell, you can go even farther than that is really a matter of assuring them that this whole premise of I get this instant huge data center, I provision it in a moment's notice, I pay for it for how much time I use it, and I can get the turnaround time I need so I can tell my boss, hey, I'm done. Why are you still screaming? Is what this is all about.
So another hot topic here at the Design Automation Conference is artificial intelligence. Now, how can it be used in the context of EDA? And can you explain how AI technology is being used specifically in the chip design space?
So AI right now, it's been an absolutely amazing cycle. You've seen the Gartner hype cycle where it talks about, you know, first you get this amazing burst of enthusiasm, and then you get the trough of disillusionment, and then eventually you get the reality of productivity. Specifically around machine learning, we kind of skipped that whole trough of disillusion. We've gone from AI and machine learning becoming a technique that people start reading about and doing some clinical experiment about 2 years ago or so, to where I'm seeing it in about 20 different projects in our environment. Now, there's two sides of that. One is the use of machine learning techniques as a new algorithmic toolkit for EDA tools. One of the first ones of those that was really successful is Solido. Solido used it for doing machine learning ways of reducing the number of simulations you have to do a full variability analysis on custom analog circuits by a factor of 10,000. We bought them 2 years ago, and they've just completely taken off in terms of adoption because what that algorithm can do to these incredibly computationally difficult problems you face when designing chips. And we've got a number of different examples like that now where anything that looks a little bit like you're looking for difficult to discern patterns patterns, and that you'll always be having to have some sort of interpolation in between patterns and still understand. Machine learning ends up being fabulous for that. So we announced machine learning for our Caliber OPC product, which is something the foundry uses to take the tape outs from the designers and put them onto mask for manufacturing. We announced it for some of our DFM technology to do hotspot analysis. I would imagine we could probably do a press release a month for the next 2 years on the other things we'll be doing internally. Now, the other side of this is there's been an absolute explosion in the level of investment and startup activity and internal activity at the existing semiconductor companies on AI chips. And what's interesting about them is that they are different enough that they will have a significant impact on the design flow. First off, because you are really trying to design algorithms, not RTL. It has taken C-level synthesis from being a hobby technology for the last 20 years to being a critical technology now for implementing these types of machine learning environments. Secondly, because the architecture looks so different, they have very different requirements in terms of how you manage the design data, verify it, and test it. And because these things, especially the data center AI, are so large, the verification problem becomes immense, and it's really driving a whole other wave of market growth in things like hardware-based verification techniques like emulation and FPGA-based prototyping. It's really kind of amazing. You look at, we've done some pulling data on funding from VCs for the semiconductor industry. And 2001, we took the big hit. 2008, we took a bigger hit. And it was practically diminutive. And you could have read all the articles about, oh, there's no more innovation in IC. No one's... Well, it exploded in the last 6 quarters to where we're now back at the funding levels for IC from VC that are like it was back in 1999, with in the neighborhood of 60 different companies receiving VC funding to go after this machine learning part. So both on our side for algorithms, on the user side for designing chips, this is probably the most impactful thing that's happened in the last decade.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about how Mentor supports AI in your tool suite.
So I mentioned a couple things that we've already announced, and maybe talking about one of those will be illustrative of what you can do there. So we have this thing called OPC. Visually, without showing you a picture, the way I describe it is that, you know, you have these shapes you're trying to put onto the wafer that create transistors, that create wires, that create connections. And OPC is like Dolby noise reduction for masks. Is what you do is you simulate the process of how the process of doing this light down into the wafer, the resist formation, the etching that you'll do, how that'll distort the design, and then you move these straight lines and create all kinds of jogs and shapes in there, all with the end goal of being able to print straight lines. Because if you try to print straight lines, you get nothing. And so when you think about that, the challenge is that you're running this incredibly detailed simulation for a 7-nanometer design on a what we call a critical layer, so maybe an N1 interconnect. To run OPC on that is likely going to take in the neighborhood of 6,000 CPUs in the neighborhood of 24 hours to run. And you just look at the needs for accuracy. If you project that out to the 3-nanometer node, you'll either be running in the neighborhood of 20,000 CPUs for 24 hours, or you'll be running those 6,000 CPUs for 3 to 4 days. And that's one layer in a 64 to 80 layer stack on an IC. So what we've done is that instead of doing this iterative simulation route over and over again to further refine each one of these little segments wherever you want to place it, we've done a training exercise to say, okay, with all these different pattern contexts that could exist, what would be the output, and then trained a neural network. And then for the first thing we do on this design, we bring the design in and we do that in through the neural network and produce an OPC. And then because accuracy on these placements needs to be within sub-nanometer ranges, we now run one simulation run. And what we get is most of our results are better accuracy. At worst, they're the same. Runtime is 4 times faster. And so that's what you're doing with this type of stuff, is you're finding ways where what you used to do through one algorithmic technique, maybe you're doing matrix solving, maybe you're doing some type of iterative operation to try to find local mini, simulated annealing. There's a whole stack of algorithms that we have in place for EDA. We have this one now that in certain application areas just blows it away in terms of performance. And so that's where we're using this stuff, is to get that better performance level.
Wow, Joe, this is super cool. is now time for your off-the-cuff question. Now, I know you're a bit of a vinyl collector of sorts, so tell me, how did you get involved with collecting vinyl?
So this will be probably more telling than I'd like it to be. So 16 years old, I lived around Philadelphia. WIOQ-FM used to have their Midnight Album Special. Now, my grandparents did not like me listening to the Midnight Album Special, but I had one of those, if you're old enough, that the little earbuds that looked like a mushroom cap, and I stuck that in my ear every night, and I'd listen to see if it was something I wanted to hear. And on this particular night, they had Nevermind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols, and I fell in love and spent the next 20 years spending anywhere from 2 to 3 nights a week in the clubs listening to music. I've got about 1,000 LPs, 1,300 CDs, and they're all kind of in that same music category that my wife passionately hates.
I can understand that. I've got a set of vinyl that I'm only allowed to listen to when I'm alone. So thank you so much for joining me, Joe. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
And thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EE Journal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EE Journal TFM. And don't forget, if you want to follow my personal Twitter account, check out Amelia D. 1978. And if LinkedIn is more your thing, well, of course, you can follow us on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, keyword EE Journal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series. And by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can check out the Fish Fry archive or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you everyone for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or even the best geeky hotspot in your city, I love that stuff, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of June 21st, 2019, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.